From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Some consensus on climate change. Eight world leaders agree to a centerpiece
of the G8
summit.
And other nations will set a long-term global goal for reducing greenhouse gases.
Mr. Bush has moved further than he ever has in agreeing to a, quote, substantial cut.
This week's G8 summit in Germany provided a rare face-to-face discussion among the world's economic powers on the problem of climate change. It also provided a notable change in rhetoric from President Bush, who advanced a plan that, while not exactly embracing absolute targets, would commit the United States to reducing carbon emissions. Why the about-face from the man who has turned his back on global partnerships like the Kyoto Agreement? One hint came from recently inaugurated French President Nicolas Sarkozy, who before he left for Germany consulted on climate issues with former Vice President Al Gore. Could it be that President Bush has been backed into a political corner with the help of Gore's book and movie about global warming, An Inconvenient Truth? If the president has been forced by public opinion to show leadership on climate change, how much credit goes to an atmosphere-hugging documentary for putting him there? We asked Andrew Revkin, longtime environment reporter for the New York Times. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
It's always a pleasure.
Before we get started on this week's events, I want to call your attention to a piece you did in 2001 after it became apparent that the White House was of no mind to sign on to the Kyoto Protocols. It said that the administration is unlikely to do anything. Whether it acts, quote, depends on domestic political pressure. Was it, in fact, domestic political pressure that motivated the president to make this turnaround?
As I wrote in 2001, you know, clearly they bet on inertia, and now they're basically being pushed to act by the political imperative. That was not there for 6 years. There was a preference to stick with the status quo as long as the American people chose to stick with the status quo. When I wrote about the last round of UN climate science reports and back in 2000, 2001, the stories were buried inside the paper. And this time they were all lead stories. The pattern is that for 6 years, the American people largely showed indifference on the climate question. And suddenly now, the last year or two, there's been this burst of focus on it.
Gee, and let's see, what happened in the last year or two? Well, there was a report on global climate change that showed a scientific consensus beyond any shadow of a doubt. There was continuing repercussions over the government's failures in the Katrina hurricane and its aftermath. And, oh, that other thing, An Inconvenient Truth, the Al Gore book and documentary, which turned out to be something along the lines of a blockbuster. How important was it?
Oh, I think it's hard to find a way to discount its importance. Not only did millions of people either buy the book or buy the DVD or see it in theaters, but then it got a huge amount of extra coverage in the news weeklies and on TV and every talk show. And so one way or the other, it would be hard to find an American who wasn't at least vaguely aware of it. Katrina happened, but I don't think it would have been linked as powerfully in the public imagination to human-caused climate change if the Gore movie hadn't followed. And having high oil prices at the same time helped to cement the idea that there's an energy problem underneath the climate problem. So that those things together all built to this crescendo. And then the Intergovernmental Panel findings this year, three different reports, each one just sort of was like a hammer pushing the nail in even further. And that's left us now very little cover for the Bush administration. And lo and behold, here comes a fresh approach to policy.
Now, you talk all the time to people in the administration. I'm curious whether you hear any Gore-related grumbling, and not so much about his claims, but about his effects.
Well, there's plenty of grumbling about his claims still, for sure. And I haven't so much heard people say, gosh, I wish he hadn't amplified this into such an issue now. In fact, I've heard recently some people have said for the Bush administration, and this is just speculation, that there's some utility to making this a big issue now because it distracts from Iraq. It gives the sense that they're actually consensus building internationally instead of being polarizing.
A convenient truth.
Yeah.
Back in happier days for the White House, when the president had a lot more political capital to spend, he seemed, along with the rest of the Republican Party, to have been able to successfully frame the climate issue as a debate. Is it my imagination, or since at least the movie came out, that the bottom has fallen out of that argument that the Republicans, you know, scarcely even try to make it anymore.
Oh, that argument is still very much alive and out there and circulating. It's not so much making it into what you'd call the mainstream media, but it's very much out there for those who choose it. And one of the most telling polls on this came out in January from the Pew Center on the Public and the Press. They really dug into what people believe and why on climate. And they found, for example, that among Republicans, those with a college degree were much more likely to be skeptical about human-caused global warming than Republicans without a college degree. And they found that Democrats with a college degree were much more conclusively believing that humans were dangerously influencing climate than Democrats without. People are in one camp or the other, and new information or more education doesn't actually move you. It actually reinforces the camp that you're in. But that's not reflected so much in what the average network show or even the average newspaper account now, I think, is much more accepted the idea that the old form of journalism where you just have one person from each side state their views of the science, and then that means you can go home having done your job. That's gone away.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Andrew Revkin is the environment reporter for the New York Times and author of The North Pole Was Here, which will come out in paperback this fall. Countless videos have emerged from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Here, Osama bin Laden's haranguing denunciations of America and the West. There, montages of IED attacks on the U.S. military set to devotional music. And, of course, hostage videos, often culminating in grisly murder. But then there's the latest video, released by a group calling itself the Islamic State of Iraq, that claims to have killed the two U.S. soldiers who have been missing since May 12th. This footage does away with the gore and the polemics. To Philip Kennicott of the Washington Post, for all its implicit horror, the video is a sort of cinematic breakthrough, complete with narrative humor and a denouement of heartbreaking subtlety.
Well, it begins with a graphic, and we've seen this before in these insurgent videos. And in this particular case, it's four fireballs coming in from the edges of the screen and exploding in the middle. And then we see images of the occupation. And these are images of American soldiers. They're tense, they're alert, they're really looking for danger. And then it switches, and we see what we would call the insurgents, but what I think is more appropriately called basically partisans in the way they want to represent themselves. These are guys out in a forest, it seems. They're under a tree. There's a beautiful light coming through. And the leader is standing over a fairly detailed map that's up in the branches of the tree, and he's pointing out the details of the attack. And what's striking is this juxtaposition of nervousness, wariness of the occupation with guys out there in the hinterlands preparing attack fairly calmly.
It's almost bucolic.
It is bucolic. And what I argue is that the word partisan here is being played with because we have a tradition of partisan literature, and it's of people who take to the hills, they take to the fields, they leave the cities where there's war and occupation, and they plan sort of the comeback of their country. And to some degree, I think that may be what's being sent as a message through this video.
There's a bit of cinema magic employed in this video. They found some footage of President Bush conducting an orchestra. Tell me how they used that.
Well, we see that footage against a computer-generated background of flames. And you see the back of the president, you see him conducting, but it's so closely cut in the images that we see in the video that you can't quite make out what he's doing, and he seems a fairly ridiculous figure. The message that we get from the video, and in fact it's spelled out explicitly at the end, is that Bush is ultimately responsible for the loss of the soldiers that prompted the release of this video.
It seems to me that the most heart-wrenching aspect of this is how the film culminates, and that is with artifacts, not with bound and gagged soldiers, not with beheadings, but just with the physical evidence that they are in fact captives.
Right. In the very last part of this video, probably about the last 40 seconds, there's a fairly dark and grainy camera pan over a credit card and some American money and a cross. And the cross almost seems to be glowing with a kind of preternatural light. And if one of the aims of this video is to set up a dichotomy between occupation and resistance, between the city and these kind of green leafy places that the attacks are being planned, well, the credit cards and the money really suggest the kind of corruption of the urban environment. The cross suggests the Christianity that seemed to be coming from the outside with the occupation. So while we scour these videos looking for particular signs of the humanity of our soldiers, in fact, these final scenes really complete the argument in the video, which is one about a set of oppositions that is much more powerful within the audience that's watching these videos.
Apart from the fact that we've now learned from your piece that we can apply cinematic criticism to insurgent videos, is there any larger significance here?
I don't want to put too much emphasis on the notion that we should sit back and do a kind of cinematic review of these things, because these are documents of people who are killing. They're documents coming out of war. The families of the two soldiers that are involved in this video cannot possibly be comfortable with somebody sitting back and looking at it purely as an aesthetic production. What's disturbing is the addition of aesthetic values to the propaganda message. That suggests that the argument is being made with more subtlety and with a longer view than we might have seen in the past. And I think that's worth taking into account. When you're really angry and you really want to get a message out, you do so in a fairly crude way. When you're planning to be in the message business for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you start learning the skills. And that, I think, should really chasten all of us.
Let me ask you one more thing, Philip. You've succeeded in deconstructing this video as a cinematic artifact, and you've observed that it's more sophisticated as a piece of narrative. But have they succeeded in any way with you as a viewer in generating sympathy with what, you know, otherwise might just seem to be barbarism?
I tried to look at this video and take the labels off everybody involved. Take the U.S. label off the military that we see in the opening scenes. Take the insurgent, the terrorist, the Iraqi, the Sunni label off the masked men that we see planning this attack. And ask myself, if I were a guy from Mars and looking at this, how effective a document would this be? I hesitate to say that it formed any sympathy with me because, you know, that's a dangerous thing to say at this point. But in a generic sense, it's a drama about occupation and resistance. And I think it probably works far better than we'd like to acknowledge.
Wow. Philip, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Philip Kennicott is culture critic for The Washington Post. This is On the Media from NPR.
Hello, podcast listeners. Let me tell you about something new we're doing. In fact, I think we may be the last people on Earth to finally do it. We're launching our first blog, one that will chronicle our upcoming trip to Russia. I'll be there for 2 weeks, starting on June 4th, with producer Mike Bolo and technical director Dylan Keefe to report on the much-beleaguered media there. You can follow our progress by clicking on the link at onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. When the news spread of the big organ donor show from the BNN network in the Netherlands, what followed was a week of outrage around the world and hand-wringing about reality television sinking to a nauseating low. The premise? Three contestants on the waiting list for kidney donations tell their sad stories to a woman called Lisa, herself in her last days with brain cancer. It was to be like the old Queen for a Day program, only instead of the most pathetic contestant winning a refrigerator freezer, he or she would win one of Lisa's kidneys. But in the final moments of the shocking broadcast, it was revealed that the entire contest was a hoax, a stunt to raise awareness about the bleak donor situation in the Netherlands. The result? Huge ratings and overnight impetus for a new national master plan for organ donation policies. Chairman of BNN Network's Laurens Dilrich explains why they decided to go forward with this bizarre idea.
One of the founders of BNN died 5 years ago of a kidney-related disease, and we always had the idea that we wanted to commemorate him in a spectacular manner. We are a network in the Netherlands that caters to a young audience, and we've done crazy stuff before.
Netherlands is unlike the rest of Europe. It's kind of an opt-in program for organ donation, much like in the States. Elsewhere in Europe, you are presumed to be an organ donor unless you opt out?
Well, in many countries you are, yeah. Like in Belgium, in Spain, in Italy. Holland is in that a little behind. As a consequence of that, the amount of organ donors is much lower in the Netherlands and the waiting lists are longer.
So you perpetrate this hoax, and it gets a lot of attention. It works like a charm. What has happened in the parliament or elsewhere in the government as a result of the stunt?
Well, the show was just last Friday, so we haven't seen anything big yet at this moment. It doesn't work like that in politics. What did happen was that the minister promised to come up with this master plan before the 1st of September, which is something that is probably going to help us to at least solve some of the problems.
Putting aside for a moment the central issue of organ donation, was this episode a statement on the state of reality television?
We had a very clear message, which was about organ donorship. Our message was not, let's try and see how far reality television has gone, because to a large extent, we as BNN also contributed to that. We're not hypocrites. We're not going to complain about that. It does say something about ways that you have to find to try to attract attention. It's very clear that if we would have done a documentary about the three contestants were real kidney patients and they are on the waiting list. If we would have made a documentary with these three people to show their lives and to show their suffering, we would have had an audience of maybe 60 or 70,000 people, and we would have had one or two small articles in the newspaper. Now people talked about this show and about organ donorship constantly for a full week, and we had a 1.7 million rating, which is extremely high in Holland. So in that way, it does say something that if you want to get your message across, very traditional things do not work anymore.
Well, since you raised the issue of confusing the audience, there was also the question of deceiving the audience. We call this a hoax, but a hoax involves telling a whole lot of lies. And you were making statements to the media about what the nature of the big organ donor show would be that obviously, in retrospect, we learned not to be so. To what extent do you have to be concerned with the credibility of BNN in the Netherlands?
That's not really a problem, and we got a lot of praise instead, so maybe that's something that I can say afterwards. It was a risk from the beginning, I do agree, and I haven't lied this much since high school. On the other hand, you have to understand that there were actual real kidney patients involved whose lives we were going to film and who were going to show us what it means for them to be on a waiting list. There were a lot of people depending on my lives. If I would have, during the week when all the attention really got bad and big and all the international press agencies were knocking at our door, would suddenly have thought, well, now I'm fed up with lying, the whole thing would have just fallen apart. I must also say that a lot of the arguments that I used to defend this kind of shows were arguments that I was meaning. I was trying to tell them that daily life for people on a waiting list is like a lottery. And I was telling them that participating in a show meant a 33% chance of getting a kidney, and that's a percentage that they never have in real life. So even though I lied about the main thing, the whole circumstances and everything around it were not a lie. And in the end, we got a lot of praise. So it's not been bad for our name, but maybe it was a risk at one point. But it was a risk we were very willing to take.
Now, you're the big boss, but I'm curious, within the organization, as you were hatching this scheme, were there any naysayers, people warning you that it was just too grave a risk or just plain wrong?
No. During the week when the attention really got big, by the way, this was like a military operation. We knew exactly when we were going to do what, and we came out with the story exactly 1 week before broadcast because we knew everyone was going to go crazy and we didn't want them trying to find out what the real story was, etc. Let's just say it became very, very important to bring the show to a good end, to find the right words. I mean, I sat down with the host to really write his final words at the moment that he lets the audience know that it's not real. Because even the people in the studio and the cameraman in the studio and everyone who was there thought that the show was real. So they were waiting in the last 5 minutes of the show for Lisa, the woman who turned out to be an actress, to decide who she was going to give her kidney to. And at that moment, the host had to say, wait a minute, why are we here? And started his story again about how problematic the situation is. And those words became very important because we realized that everyone was watching and that if we didn't do it right, people were going to judge us for it. There were people in the press department who were talking to journalists from all over the world every day, and they didn't even know that it was a hoax. So they needed to trust us a lot, but fortunately they do.
Let me ask you one more thing. Kidney patients can get a kidney via donation from someone who was killed in an accident or something like that. But they can also get donations from living donors. The three people who appeared on the program, have they since received offers from living donors for their own kidneys?
Well, everyone who works in the media knows that if you do strange things that you get very strange reactions. So already during the week when people didn't know that it was a hoax, we were confronted with emails and phone calls by people who said, I'm willing to give my kidney to one of the two people we're going to lose. We didn't take that very seriously, and we also don't see it as our role as a broadcast to go into that. I mean, we just refer these people to medics or to hospitals. That's not how we want to solve this problem in the Netherlands. We don't want to tell people, hey, you have to give up your kidney while you're alive. We just want people to register, either yes or no, but to register and to make clear what their preferences are.
All right. Lawrence, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lawrence Drillich is chairman of the Dutch TV network BNN. Last weekend, in a full-page ad in the Washington Post, porn king and First Amendment militant Larry Flint floated a lucrative offer, $1 million to anyone who could provide documented evidence of sexual indiscretion by a member of Congress or other high government official. This wasn't the first time Flint has pulled this stunt. In 1998, during the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, a similar offer turned up dirt on Republican Congressman Bob Livingston, then Speaker-elect of the House. Livingston quickly acknowledged marital infidelity and resigned. In a subsequent interview with the New York Times, Livingston called Flint a bottom feeder, and Flint says the Times called him for response.
They called me for a comment, and I said, yeah, that's right, but look what I found when I got down there.
You got anything juicy yet?
We got over 200 leads. We have to follow them all the way down. We will be happy if between 2 to 4% materialized into something.
Checkbook journalism is widely sneered at. It raises questions about the motives of the person cashing the check. For $1 million, someone might even be tempted to, you know, lie.
Look, many networks are already using checkbook journalism. You see them promote movies on the morning shows, and they tie them in with a book or a special interview report or something. It all tallies up to the same thing. What matters if you're paying for it, as long as you get reliable material?
And how do you know that what you're getting is reliable?
First of all, we're very strict. We want to see hotel lodging reports, photographs. We want to see graphic information that will not leave any doubt that this affair took place. If we don't get something solid, we drop it because we don't want to get in that kind of litigation.
All right. Now, 23 years ago, I sat in a hotel suite in Washington, D.C., with you and your late wife, Althea. You were going to show me at that time what you said were very compromising videotapes of President Reagan's inner circle. You never did come up with them. At some point, when do we have to question your credibility?
I do have still to this day. The actress was Vicki Morgan. Videotapes of her with some of Reagan's cabinet members.
I've been waiting for 23 years. You ever going to show them to me?
My lawyers advised me not to. They say that these people are all out of office now, and we could have some liability there.
I'm curious, though, what if your offer turned up scandal and hypocrisy on the Democratic side of the aisle?
We're looking for Democrats. You know, people think, because I'm a civil libertarian, I'm only after Republicans. That's not true. I'm after anybody. But I tell you, in the leads that we got, it seems like about 80% of them are Republicans.
We should hasten to add, though, that the results of what comes in over your transom are not statistically significant, and they may or may not reflect the actual average of congressional impropriety. Let me ask you this. You'd have a personal history with sleazy Republicans playing holier-than-thou and making your life miserable. I'm thinking particularly of Charles Keating, the Ohio banker who got you prosecuted in Cincinnati on smut charges back in the 70s, right, and then later turned up smack in the middle of the savings and loan swindles of the late 80s. Is this a journalistic enterprise afoot here, or is it just spite?
No. I love politics. I love my country. I love publishing, and I mix it up just as much as I can. And, you know, like I say, they've got me in a wheelchair now. There's not much more that they can do to me, so I want to give them hell for the rest I'm going to be around.
All right, Larry. Thank you very much for joining us.
All right, bye.
Larry Flint is the founder and publisher of Hustler magazine. Sex scandals have, of course, killed political careers without the use of full-page ads or payments to sources. Tom Fiddler was a reporter at the Miami Herald in 1987 when rumors were flying around that Democratic presidential hopeful Gary Hart was having extramarital affairs. When someone approached the Miami Herald with information and demanded payment, Fiddler refused on principle. But he still managed to break the story. Tom, welcome to On the Media.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
I remember Gary Hart saying, if you don't believe I'm clean, follow me. You followed him.
Well, we did, although we had actually already, by the time that was published, met with the source. This is the woman who called me initially wanting to sell a photograph, the one that had Senator Hart and Donna Rice sitting in his lap. I told her we didn't pay for photographs, but I suppose I ultimately persuaded her that it was in the country's best interest for her to help me anyway, and she did.
That was 1987. This is 2007. 20 years later, other forces have intervened. One of them is Larry Flint. Mm-hmm. Another is the tabloids, who have introduced money into the game.
Mm-hmm. The ground for this was actually plowed pretty well in the 1992 presidential campaign when Jennifer Flowers showed up at a press conference sponsored by the, not the Inquirer, the Star, and she announced that she'd had an affair with then-Governor Clinton for a number of years. She was well paid for that, as I think everybody knew.
Well, you mentioned Jennifer Flowers. You know, she had documentary evidence. She had answering machine tapes. So she had the goods. And after all, police pay for information all the time that can lead to convictions. Publishers buy tell-all books from news figures and so forth. If the story checks out, what is the problem with paying for it?
Well, I think what you're hoping to get is the ideal situation, and that is where someone's motives in coming forward and providing information that is relevant, by the way, not just scandalous for scandal's sake, that the ideal would be that someone's motives are pure, or at least as pure as I suppose you can have in a human situation or in a political situation.
All sources have one motive or another, and some far less straightforward and transparent than just money. You know, in Washington journalism, you never get a piece of information where someone doesn't stand to gain something.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. And our role as journalists is to present the information in a way that enables people to make an informed judgment. And part of that process is to try to understand the motives there so that they can assess, you know, do I really want to believe this or is this tainted? Maybe that fact is right, but they're holding back on something else that would be mitigating. It's very tricky territory.
Clearly, the Gary Hart, Donna Rice story found its way into the Miami Herald without Knight Ridder having to write a check to anybody. But, you know, you got to hand it to Larry Flint. Nobody else broke the Bob Livingston story. Whether it should have been broken or not is an open question, but the Speaker of the House designate had to leave the Congress on the basis of a story bought and paid for by Larry Flint. Was he doing some sort of public service by exposing Livingston's hypocrisy?
Yeah. If you put Larry Flint and public service in the same sentence, you feel like you almost need to take a shower later. Yeah. But first of all, I do think that that was relevant information. That said, I would hope that journalists would have been able to get at that information without having paid for it, simply by saying, look, this is information that for the good of the republic, you ought to be willing to step forward and make this allegation known. Well, you know, it didn't happen. Larry Flint was able to pry it loose with his checkbook, so it's out there. But I put that in the category of the same way that sometimes the only way law enforcement can get information is to grease the proverbial palm of somebody who's less than savory. I suppose we just wish we didn't have to go that route.
Oh, so you're on your way to the Shorenstein Center at Harvard to study media issues. Will you tell your students, take careful notes and bring a big wad of cash?
Yeah, I would tell them not to do that. I would tell them to try every possible way to avoid that kind of a situation. I know there are times when a source will say, look, at the only way I can give you this information, if I lose my job, I need some kind of help. And so, you know, as a journalist, you might look around and say, well, how can I help? Maybe I can see to it that this person can get another job. Or there are ways around, I would hope, just pulling out a checkbook and putting a bunch of zeros after a number.
Tom, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Tom Fiedler is retired executive editor at the Miami Herald. Coming up, unbought TV pilots get a second life on the internet, and a sport called parkour spreads around the world there. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, President Bush and Vice President Cheney unintentionally helped Fox, NBC, ABC, and CBS win a court case against the Federal Communications Commission. President Bush made his contribution at last year's G8 summit when an open microphone caught him using a not-for-prime-time word.
See, the irony is that what they need to do is get Syria to get Hezbollah to stop doing this.
The FCC calls that a fleeting expletive uttered during a live taping and broadcast unintentionally. A federal court in New York Monday ruled that the networks cannot be held responsible for fleeting expletives. The case centered on specific instances involving awards show gaffes by Bono, Nicole Richie, and Cher. But the court actually cited President Bush and Vice President Cheney's infamous use of expletives, saying that it is unrealistic to pretend that these words are not a part of everyday speech. A victory for the networks, yes, but is the culture losing out? The Parents Television Council works to keep expletives and other obscenity off the airwaves. Its president, Tim Winter, says he is disappointed by the ruling.
We think it's irresponsible for the networks to be suing for the right to use the F-word in front of children, which is exactly what this case centered on. What they said was that the rule that the FCC had been trying to implement, which was not allowing the F-word to be used when children are in the audience before 10 p.m., they said, no, that runs afoul of the First Amendment. And we believe that their ruling runs afoul of almost 80 years of jurisprudence on ownership of the public airwaves and over the indecency laws that have been enforced for many decades.
As a father of three, believe me, I can argue both sides of this question. The coarsening of the culture, the defining of deviancy downward is often quite disturbing. But it seems to me that being spontaneously rude on live TV or even rude with malice aforethought shouldn't be actually against the law, and certainly not for the broadcaster. How do you justify fining a network for something that it didn't actually do, but just merely, you know, inadvertently broadcast?
In the cases that were ruled upon by the court, you had two award shows, which are watched by millions of children. The TV network's ratings for those programs deem them appropriate for family viewing. when you hear an expletive aired on an award show, and then again the next year, the same award show, a different celebrity utters the same word. At some point in time, this no longer becomes fleeting. It becomes a pattern. And I think the networks not only didn't discourage their celebrities from doing that, I think there's some sort of tacit encouragement that they want the stars to be edgy because they are looking for young teen audiences that the advertisers want most.
Before we go any further, I just want to establish your bona fides on this subject. It would be easy to jump to the conclusion that you're some sort of hardcore conservative, Republican, religious right, public scold. But you got into this debate from another place. Tell me about that.
I am none of the things that you just described. Well, public scold, I guess it's up for the public to decide. I am an activist. I'm also a long time, 20 plus years in the entertainment industry. So I grew up career-wise in the industry as a father of a 9-year-old daughter. It became abundantly apparent to me several years ago just how impactful the media was on small children, regardless of how diligent a parent is at protecting what their children are watching. I'm not a conservative. I know that this sounds like the type of message you'd hear from somebody who is. And this is a universal issue. And again, I think that the law, as it was intended to be interpreted by the FCC, allowed a balance between those who have children, those who don't, those who want four-letter words on television, those who don't. And I think what the court has done is tilt that balance unfairly.
Tim, I'm not sure the court even considered this question, but the fact is most Americans get their TV via cable or satellite. As far as they're concerned, a broadcast station is just another channel on the remote control. And the channels that don't originate as broadcasts are under no obligation to observe the rules that you've been discussing. If the public can't tell the difference between broadcast and cable, why hold broadcasters to a different standard?
Well, there are 20 million households that do not subscribe to cable because they don't want to have that kind of material coming into their home. You have a disparity between a network that the public, through the FCC, hands a license to this network and says, use public property for free. They, I believe, have a different standard than, for instance, a network that says, you know what, I'm going to try to market to a consumer so that they can intentionally subscribe and receive my network.
Do you really have any evidence that the majority of the public is substantially offended when the F-bomb gets dropped on the air? Or, you know, in this day and age, is it just, you know, water off a duck's back?
Every major poll across the country, not just of PTC members, not just of people who might happen to go to church three times a week, the overwhelming sense is there are certain words at certain times that should not be broadcast on television. The sense of the nation is overwhelming on this, and I think that was demonstrated last year when the Congress voted to increase the fines for broadcasters who break the indecency law. It passed unanimously in the Senate. Unanimously. It passed in the House of Representatives 379-35. When have 479 members of Congress in both houses ever agreed on anything? The reason is they know that this is the sense of the nation. And again, I think it's unfortunate that two judges in New York City have decided that, no, the F word in front of kids in these broadcast shows is okay.
Tim, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here today.
Tim Winter is the president of the Parents Television Council. He joined us from Los Angeles. It's that time of year when many television producers get the bad news that the pilot they've slaved over for the past year or more, that's been tweaked to accommodate the network's demands and refined to appeal to just about everyone, has been rejected. Of the 54 comedy pilots that were actually produced, only a select few have been picked up. You might think that the shows that get thrown out are never seen again, but of course you'd be wrong. Rejected pilots have gone viral on sites like YouTube and BitTorrent and have amassed quite the audience. The rejected Nobody's Watching has had a combined total of 14.2 million views.
This is a message for all of you TV networks. Lately, your sitcoms suck.
They suck!
I mean, come on! According to Jim, awful. Good Morning, Miami.
Good night, funny.
That's a little bit from Nobody's Watching. Hugh Hart wrote about the phenomenon in Wired, and he joins me now. Hugh, welcome to OTM.
Good to be here.
So this life after death for sitcoms, when did the phenomenon begin?
It began cropping up, I think, about when a drama called Global Frequency got turned down from the WB network, and somehow or another, the drama wound up on BitTorrent, and people started downloading it in a campaign to have it released on DVD, and all these other kinds of effects followed. A little bit of subversive uploading onto the web. So far, the networks have taken an adversarial stance towards unofficial postings of their copyrighted material on YouTube, MySpace, and other sites like BitTorrent.
Now, one explanation for this hardline legal approach could be that the production companies and the networks don't want to create a precedent of giving away content that they own. But you actually pose another possibility.
Absolutely. And this is something that each and every person I spoke to for this story brought up unsolicited. It's a question of network executive ego. These guys are paid and paid well to pick winners at the best and at the very least contenders that they think have a shot at gathering up substantial primetime audience. If it were to turn out that one of the sitcoms that they rejected as being a loser winds up gaining a following on the internet, it makes them look less than perspicacious.
So if for the time being most networks and production companies are clamping down, a couple have been a little bit more liberal. There is an Adam Sandler-produced program called Gay Robot, which is preposterously sophomoric, at least mildly offensive, and pretty funny, at least the small segment I heard. In fact, let's listen to a bit of it.
Hey, Gay Robot, where are you?
I'm across campus at the student union.
Well, come over. We're watching the football game.
Hello. Hello? Was that a chick?
No, it's Gay Robot.
Gay Robot? What's that?
You haven't met Gay Robot yet? He's my roommate here at the frat. Professor Edwards built him.
While Professor was building the robot, he accidentally spilled the wine cooler on him. And he came out gay.
Really?
Hey, hey, hey!
Now, that's still on YouTube. Tell me why it's still there.
The pilot was rejected a few months ago by Comedy Central. And the idea now is to do what they call a proof of concept, meaning let's throw it out there and see if the comedy actually works with ordinary comedy fans and see what kind of a response it gets. Then we can take that as ammunition and return to maybe Comedy Central or some other network and say, look, it's got 14 million hits online. We still think it's a viable concept, even though it's been turned down earlier. What do you say you give it a second shot?
Has anyone actually seriously discussed using the internet to create the world's largest focus group?
That is exactly where I think things are likely to head in the next year or two. They came close to doing that with Nobody's Watching in the sense that NBC had picked up the show after it had been rejected by the WB, and NBC said, well, maybe we should give this a shot, and they asked the producers to start producing webisodes to kind of take the temperature of the internet fan base and see what kind of response the characters and the comedic sensibility might have online.
We thank you, Father, for the American Broadcasting Company and the miracle of the electromagnetic wave so that Will and I may experience this unparalleled television event.
Amen.
We thank you for the others.
Amen.
We thank you for the hatch.
Amen.
We thank you for killing Michelle Rodriguez.
Amen.
For the rock and roll hobbit.
And we do not thank you for all the copycat TV shows that are on this season. Not amen.
Now, the number 14.2 million views so far for the rejected Nobody's Watching would seem to impeach the network's judgment. But, you know, if you think about it, 14.2 million viewers is kind of like one episode of the sort of average-rated network primetime sitcom. So how impressed should we be that over a period of months, 14.2 million people around the world have watched this thing?
That's a fair question. And it's true that you need big, big numbers to qualify as a primetime hit. It might be a question, frankly, of television creative types thinking more in terms of using some of their talent towards web-specific content that costs a heck of a lot less to produce. Maybe if they scaled down, produce something that was shorter, but one hopes just as funny, if not funnier. That might be an entirely new model unto itself.
Hugh, thank you very much.
Thanks for your time, Bob.
Hugh Hart wrote about life after death TV pilots for Wired magazine. If you saw the opening scene of the most recent James Bond movie, Casino Royale, you may have unknowingly been introduced to what some are calling a new sport, parkour. It's a sort of freestyle acrobatics or gymnastics, only the apparatus is ordinary urban architecture. The most adventurous devotees seem to defy gravity, running up against vertical walls, flipping over handrails, leaping, almost flying from rooftop to rooftop. While skateboarding and snowboarding had their underground VHS tapes to help capture a broader following, parkour may be the first sport made popular entirely via the internet. Its origins can be traced to one man in the French suburbs, David Bell, who had no intention of popularizing anything. A couple of clips of Bell were posted on the web, and soon aspiring youngsters were posting their own clips and meeting online to form their own parkour clans everywhere from Lithuania to Japan. New Yorker writer Alec Wilkinson made a pilgrimage to Paris to talk with parkour's patriarch, and he says the mythic tales Bell heard about his acrobatic fireman father stamped his destiny.
All the stories that he heard about his father were sort of hero stories, Superman stories and Tarzan stories. David wanted to be Spider-Man, and so he really literally devised ways of swinging from tree to tree and jumping over rocks and climbing up walls and leaping from one stairwell to another.
Now, because it is so breathtaking to watch and it's stunning video, it is just made to order for the YouTube world, eh?
Yes. I can't think of a circumstance like it in which a completely private activity engaged in by a solitary person with his friends became something that spread around the world. Of course, it's all and entirely because of the internet.
Now, you mentioned that David had dreamed of being Spider-Man.
Yes.
Do I understand that he actually had the opportunity to be Spider-Man?
He did. He did. He was offered the role, I think, for Spider-Man 3 of being the body double, as it were. It had been his childhood ambition, really, to be that kind of figure. In the end, though, when finally turned this opportunity down because he had come to feel sufficiently committed to pursuing his own performance of parkour, he reminds me of what I have heard and read about the figure of Charlie Parker. He seems committed entirely to what he is doing. He doesn't seem to be one of those people who sees necessarily choices between engagement with the world or disengagement. He simply really wants to do parkour. He'd like to bring it himself to as many people as possible by means of performances and shows, but he's not sufficiently ambitious to really figure out a way to make it happen. Before he does, I suspect someone else will figure out how to popularize it. Certainly, the man who was in Casino Royale, Sebastian Foucan, has stolen the march on him a little bit, and it's one of the reasons they no longer speak.
Now, it's clear that much like the videos, the sport itself has gone viral. People all over the world are doing parkour.
Yeah.
Does David Bell feel that he has Does he feel he's lost control of his invention?
I would think no, because, again, he is so revered that, you know, in other parts of the world, there are right now arguments going on about whether or not David Bell would approve of that maneuver. You know, here's a new thing I'm trying. Well, that's not parkour, man. Dude, that's not parkour. Very heated, vehement kind of website exchanges. So I don't think he probably feels he's lost control. I think it may happen once marketers really get hold of it. You know, once Nike really figures out how to build a parkour shoe.
One more thing. As a former bored adolescent, I can say that I've invented, probably half a dozen sports myself, including my beloved sock golf, which is played with a couple of balled up socks in a trash can, indoors or outdoors. Do they have any chance to go viral, or do they have to be just breathtaking to witness in order for this phenomenon to play out?
Well, I'm sure it has a lot to do with the dramatic impact, and you alluded to it before. It's so spectacular to see. And I cannot myself watch any of these films of Bell as many times as I have without my hands and feet breaking into a sweat. It's a little like watching Macbeth and sort of wanting to yell out from the audience, "No, don't do it!" It seems to me it was like hearing the Beatles for the first time. It was so different from everything else. It had so much vitality. To the kid who was wired to receive this kind of particular electronic charge through the screen of his computer, I think it's all but irresistible. And it plays on those adolescent themes of superheroes and fantasies and having a response for life that seems larger than life, when in fact adolescence is all about being utterly sort of terrified of life around you.
Alec, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And, you know, when you get ready to do 7,000 words on sock golf, you just give me a holler.
I'll go to the source.
Alec Wilkinson is a writer for The New Yorker. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited this week pretty much by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Madeline Ellish and Andrea Ambro. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.